Hello, all. Welcome to the God Said Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an anarchist independent press dedicated to publishing socially engaged literature. With me today is Hans Berger, one of the other editors of Kai Draconis Books, and a special guest, the author of our most recent publication, The Sodomites, Adi Kalai. And, you know, Adi, we're just super happy to have you on, super happy to get some of your thoughts about your novel, which I think is pretty fantastic, and just really enjoyed reading it, really enjoyed going over it and looking through it and doing all the layout stuff. It's been a great experience. I have some more politically oriented questions just because, you know, that happens to be something I'm super interested in, but I'd like to talk about the craft of the novel first and foremost. And so I'm gonna hand things over to Hans and let him ask the questions that he had, because he was very interested in the craft perspective. So Hans, what do you have to say?
Yeah. So the first thing that I was wondering about, and this is kind of the broadest question, so I thought it might make sense to start as broadly as possible, but I just was wondering what you see as being the role of prose fiction in a society that is as saturated as ours is with every kind of different entertainment option and every kind of electronic media, right? And whether or not you think that prose fiction can maintain relevance in a society, in the greater society, or if it inevitably has to become a niche thing.
Yeah, that's a very big question. I guess in my view, prose enables you to enter another person's head, you know, like their intimate thoughts and obsessions, in a way that no other media really can. Like, and then fiction can allow you to experiment with other life forms, experiences, and cultures, and sort of imagine social change and see it unfolding in front of you. So put together, kind of prose fiction can, I think, expand social imagination in a totally unique way. So like reading The Dispossessed, for example, or The Left Hand of Darkness, both by, you know, the giant of anarchist fiction and science fiction, Ursula K. Le Guin. To me personally, it was life-changing in ways that no other media can be. So I don't know if newer media can displace it. I know that I can't imagine myself without it. And I imagine other people feel the same, you know. Some of them as young as my 7-year-old bookworm niece. And perhaps also those of us who feel this way can put our minds together and make this planet more livable.
Okay. So the other part of the question that I had then was what kinds of powers you think prose fiction has that as an aesthetic tool or as a political tool that other media don't. But it sounds like you addressed that naturally in what you said. So cool. Okay. So that ties in a little bit to something else I was thinking about as I was reading this, which is, so Patrick and I went to school to study writing together. And one thing that we talked about a lot when we were studying together was reconciling what we kind of thought of at the time as being artistic and didactic motivations in writing, right? The part of the writer that is interested in kind of creating an aesthetic object, and the part of the writer that's interested in conveying a social or a political idea, right? And we had always, as like young writers, we'd always thought of those things as being either potentially or necessarily in tension with each other, right? But it seems like you've come to a kind of a pretty confident balance of those goals in this work, right? And so I was just wondering, do you see those as being in tension or not? And how do you kind of reconcile them against each other?
Yeah, so that's a great question, hugely important to any political writer. And I'd say that my way of reconciling this tension has shifted over the years of writing the book. So I started the Sodomites as a propaganda project. I was inspired by how Edward Abbey's Monkey Wrench Gang had inspired the radical environmentalist group Earth First. And I wanted to use fiction to imagine what a similar environmental radicalism and kind of deep ecology might look like in the Israeli-Palestinian context. So I started off seeing the story as a vehicle through which I would convey my ideas in politics. But the thing that happens in fiction that both of you as writers are surely familiar with is that when you give life to your characters, their own logic can sort of overwrite your initial intentions. And as my characters started making their own decisions, the pontificating speeches that I tried to impose on them for my for my own propagandistic purposes became increasingly awkward. And I found myself during the revision process sort of stripping down the proselytizing to the extent that at times I was obscuring their original intentions. So there was this conflict of politics versus art, right? As if one detracted from the other. But eventually, what I think I came to understand, and here one of my readers was really helpful and sort of pushing me in that direction. I think what I understood was that the more aesthetically compelling the object, the more powerful and convincing its messaging. So I gradually sort of released myself from the responsibility of convincing other people or sharing a message that I thought was important, and instead tried to enjoy creating. And what happens in the process, I mean, I hope, is that the writer's worldview, whether the reader agrees with it or not, but the worldview becomes more appealing and palatable.
And that actually kind of segues pretty well into an issue that I thought was very interesting, and I'd like to, since Chris Malmberg, the other editor, couldn't be with us today, I wanted to at least kind of work one of his ideas into the conversation, and this seems like a good point to do it. He, you know, he was very interested in the moral ambiguity of the novel and how, you know, what the novel starts out somewhat straightforward. We see these different activists, these different radicals trying to fight what looks like an extremely unjust situation. And then as the novel progresses, more and more moral ambiguities kind of pop up. And we wonder, for example, if a certain character should have killed another towards the end of the novel, or if, you know, one character who towards the end of the novel, you know, maybe does something pretty awful, you know, awful in context. And, you know, we're left wondering, you know, are these the right actions? You know, even though we're fighting oppression, is this the right action? And I think it's interesting that you bring up this idea that the more you loosen up on the proselytizing and just let the novel be an aesthetic object, the more powerful it becomes. So I'm wondering if, you know, achieving moral ambiguity actually is more effective at, you know, proselytizing readers than actually having characters that deliver speeches, like you say.
Yeah, totally. I think, and that's what happened when I sort of released myself from the responsibility of trying to educate people. And instead I was like following my own questions and obsessions and allowing the characters to figure things out for themselves. So yeah, so the novel asks big questions about is killing another person justified, and when, and under what conditions, and when is it self-defense, and when are we, when is it extrapolation, and when are you giving in to, when are you allowing your use of force to bring you into a, kind of suicidal line of actions, or where, when are you led by ego and or masculinity, and so on. And I think what fiction should do is, rather than try to answer these questions, is pose them and allow the readers to decide. And I think that's also the more the more anarchist approach, like not to give people the answers, but to empower all of us.
That brings to my mind another question I had about the novel as a political object. One of the things I struggle with is something that you bring up in the novel, which is propaganda of the deed, which is, to my mind is another word, phrase that's similar to, the anarchist philosophy of direct action, that, we need to be doing things, not just, voting or whatever, not letting representatives do things for us. And I wonder, do you think that this novel in particular, and novels in general, can be examples of propaganda of the deed, or is writing not on that same level of being a direct actor?
Yeah, good question. So in the broader historical context of like 19th century anarchism, propaganda of the deed carries a certain historical baggage that wasn't necessarily aiming for. Like, it brings up connotations of assassination of heads of state and this kind of lone wolf strategy that the anarchist movement arguably rejected, and that Emma Goldman was ultimately disillusioned with, and so on. Though I do think the subconscious symbolism the term entails has literary significance in the book. But my point is that, as you said, like, the Sodomites' concept of propaganda by deed is more like what we think of as direct action. Rather than trying to vote for an end to environmental destruction and sign petitions even as the world burns, the Sodomites try to actually pull the plug on a suicidal and genocidal system. So the worldview is like, actions say more than words. What matters is what you do, not what you say. And seeing anarchism not as a doctrine, but as a political practice. Or as Prof says, and I think I'm quoting from the book, Prof says, no manifestos, no doctrine. Let the action speak, thus allowing a one-to-one relationship between practice and theory. So drawing the theory through the practice and not the other way around. And as for your specifically on your question, like, I wouldn't say that writing political fiction is direct action in and of itself. It's more like it creates a space where effective action can be imagined, where strategy can be debated, and also from which actors can draw inspiration. And this last bit is what inspired me to write the Sodomites. Like, I'm thinking of what would be inspiring for me to read as an actor, as an activist or a radical in Israel-Palestine. And that's, I think, also generally like this opening of space in fiction makes the writing worthwhile.
Sure. That makes sense. That makes sense. It seems to me like, I think I agree. I think, writing is certainly important, and there's something about spreading ideas, that is absolutely necessary to resistance to, oppression, hegemony, and all these things. But it's not quite the same as, knocking down a statue or smashing the windows of a cop car or something like that. And on that question of which, we seem to kind of be talking about violence here, we're talking about direct action you know, the way anarchy and anarchism is presented in the media, especially now in the U.S. with you know, Donald Trump, you know, blaming everything, all these, you know, protests and whatnot, blaming violence on anarchists and whatnot, and it seems like anarchism as a movement has kind of some trouble distancing itself from violence. You know, it's certainly violence is acceptable to most anarchists, you know, minus a few anarcho-pacifists. But it's still, you know, we tend to view violence as self-defense, usually, you know, self-defense because the state is operating oppressively on us. And I was wondering if you specifically ever found any tension between your own beliefs and your own feelings about violence and the ideas that the novel's characters espouse about violence, what they say about violence.
Particularly, can you hear
go on, Hans?
Yeah, I was going to say, I find that particularly interesting because one of the things that you've talked about is, if I'm remembering the phrase right, allowing the characters the space to find their own answers, right? And when you do that, I guess the question is, when you do that, are you ever dismayed, shocked, surprised, opposed to the answers that the characters find?
Yeah, both raising really great issues. So the question of generally violence and nonviolence, the way nonviolence can be weaponized by the state to pacify a movement, and also how this plays out in the book, and do the characters sort of surprise me or kind of defy my intentions with their own choices. So I would say, just to respond to that last part first. Firstly, I think none of the characters in The Sodomites fall for political nonviolence, like nonviolence as a doctrine. They're either culturally and personally disinclined, Tzvika and Yaniv and Aya, or they have learned to see it as a tool that protects the state and pacifies social movements. Prof is more of that characteristic. And I mean, this doesn't mean that there's no space for nonviolence practitioners in the movement. Like in the Battle of Otniel, like when there's this big climactic protest in the novel, we see like the important and even life-saving role played by nonviolent activists who use their privilege and the legitimacy that nonviolence can offer in a sort of confluence with Palestinians throwing stones, cutting fences, and like the Sodomites doing their sabotage on the other side. And it's all kind of works in confluence in order where the nonviolence practitioners kind of lower the brutality and force the Israeli army by compelling it to abide by its own shooting regulations. Like the Israeli army can't shoot at a crowd when there are Israeli citizens in the crowd, even if people are throwing stones and so on. Yes, but major ethical questions and use of force come up in the novel as well. And this too was somewhat of a thought experiment. As you said, Hans, like opening the space, like a way to grapple with major problems that resistance movements have been facing. Like, are executions ever justified? So as you said, Patrick, like self-defense is not an issue. Like, of course it is legitimate, but at what point are you risking actually, at what point are you extrapolating? At what point are you risking actually corrupting the movement and yourself? Or letting force guide you in a suicide.
Right.
So the novel allowed me to raise these questions and examine how these scenarios play out. But then again, ultimately the readers find their own answers.
Yeah. So I don't, the next few questions they don't necessarily segue super easily from the ones that we were talking about, but they're just kind of other details of writing choices you made that I thought were interesting. One of those is the way that you have occasionally woven yourself in as actually a character within the novel, right? The omnipotent first-person narrator seems to, on a few occasions, actually crystallize into you as a person within the world of the novel. And I thought I found that to be an intriguing choice. I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit about what effect you were trying to create with that and how you made the decision to do that.
Yeah, I really like these questions, by the way, because you don't necessarily think about this when you do it as a writer. And this sort of, now I'm sort of forced to think about it as a choice, and it was a choice, but I wouldn't say that I was consciously trying to do anything specific with the conceit. It's more like it made sense to mention me because I was there and I'm not one of the other characters. Or if I wasn't there, like, and this is a totally imagined protest, I could still imagine myself being there as a face in the crowd, not as one of the protagonists, but as an observer, as someone to sort of, as Edward Abbey said, I wouldn't push the plunger, but I'd hold the flashlight. So this is me kind of actually there holding the flashlight. Like at the protest, the Battle of Othniel, or with a group of activists rebuilding homes that were demolished by the army, and so on. But then there are, of course, subconscious mechanisms at play, and I think some of the effect it might create using this technique is a sort of distancing between the writer and the actions of the protagonists. So like it's as if I'm saying it wasn't me who did these things, I was just an observer, and so on. Maybe it's a bit of a like a protective choice of mine as a writer. I'm not sure. I mean, how did you see it?
So I guess I saw it as being a way of, it's interesting actually that you make the point that you saw it as a way of distancing yourself a little bit from the actions of the protagonists, right? Because it seemed to me like the reaction I had as a reader was a little bit of the opposite, right? That you were establishing your personal relationship to that world, right? And I think about, like, I mean, as a writer, like the novel that I published on our press was about a particular sort of sexual subculture that a lot of people find very off-putting, myself included, right? And so it was, if anything, I didn't do anything within the novel to try to establish this, but, you know, most people that read it, I didn't want their response to be, oh, this must be something that the writer has a personal relationship to in this way, right? Whereas by putting yourself literally on scene in the protest, you're establishing a personal stake as an individual in the subject matter that, to some extent, I feel like one of the privileges of fiction is, as writers, we're allowed to kind of disavow that personal stake in the subject matter, right? Oh, I did some research, you know, well, here's my novel about meth addicts, right? I'm not a meth addict, I've never done meth, but I did some research about meth, and so I've written this novel about meth addicts, right? And you can certainly argue about, there are, I'm sure, are many arguments to be had and that have been had about the legitimacy of that, right? But I think that one of the, if you assume that one of the benefits of the fictional model is to allow yourself to project into thought processes viewpoints that are not your own for the sake of exploring ideas or creating more empathetically, then you have to grant some privilege at least to project yourself into characters who are very unlike you or live in worlds very unlike yours, right? And that's certainly, there are many arguments to be had about the limits of that, but some amount of that I think is inherent in the form. And what you've done by, my sense as a reader was that what you had done by putting yourself on scene is kind of abdicate that privilege, right? You are projecting a greater level of personal investment as an individual. You're kind of letting down that shield of like, this is a novel, this is fiction, I'm just exploring ideas with people who are unlike me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love that reading of it. I suppose it does both. Like, I am a body, clearly, like I state clearly on which side of the fence I'm on, but still I'm not a protagonist. So I am not Yaniv or Aya, right? Or that's some of what I was, that's some of what comes to mind when I think of the use of this conceit. And I think I was also interested in breaking the form a little bit. And seeing what happens, and seeing whether someone like you has this reading of it.
Are you worried that some people might take it as some form of metafiction, which it doesn't seem to be really at all? But you know, our other editor, Chris, he loves metafiction, and I bet you he would absolutely see this as a metafictional device. Some kind of comment on fiction. Is there anything? Is that? Would you like to speak to that idea?
Yeah. So, I think when I wrote the first draft, it had more metafiction. Like more of that, of actually disrupting the form, like the characters, like in Don Quixote, start talking directly to the experience of being imaginary characters written in real time. But ultimately, in revision, I decided to keep the narrative consistent, and I wanted the characters to stay real. But I did keep those small tidbits where the author shows on set, so there is, I suppose there is a metafictional layer, like here's this person at the protest, imagining the thoughts of all of the people around them, but also like maybe I as a reader can also imagine myself inside of that scene at that protest, or participating in some way, and I think that's also some of what I'm hoping, consciously or not, you know, create.
Yeah, there's in that same vein, there is a technique that you use toward the end of the novel where there's a kind of a transition into second person, right, where you're using second person to narrate the experiences of one of the characters, and then there's a chapter break, and over the chapter break you continue in second person but with a different viewpoint character, right? And that particular move, the filtering into second person and then switching viewpoint characters while still staying in the second person, just was a really interesting little set of kind of ballet tricks, right? Like I tried to think of another novel I had read that did that exact sequence of craft choices, and I couldn't really think of anything. And I mean, you mentioned that one of the goals of putting yourself in as a narrator was to allow the reader to more vividly imagine themselves in that space, right? And I think, I mean, my understanding of the use of second person is that it's another tool to really kind of create a psychological closeness between the reader and the viewpoint character, right? And so, I mean, I'm assuming that you use that tool for that end. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about the decision to move into second person and the way that you kind of retain it across multiple characters in that space.
Yeah. So what happened there was that when I was writing and getting really close to the characters in those moments, they started sort of talking to themselves in the second person. And I think this, like, I think in this way sometimes, sort of addressing myself as you, and maybe other people experience that as well. And then, so when you write the first draft, you sort of, I sort of allowed myself to stream of consciousness write it. And then in revision, oftentimes you strip some of those experiments, but that particular conceit, I noticed that it didn't detract or confuse me, that it actually did feel closer while reading it, like still inside their heads despite the second person. So I thought, like, this can bring the readers closer, but it also adds another symbolic layer. This is a sort of at a stage in the novel where things are really getting out of hand for the sodomites. And like Tzvika talked to himself in the second person, it also has this element of disassociation where in these traumatic moments, he's being distanced from himself.
One thing that I thought was interesting also, speaking of the, you mentioned a little bit earlier some of the metafictional elements, and I don't know if this would exactly qualify as meta, but it was kind of a choice that I thought was intriguing. There are a few references to stories by an author who I believe is fictional named Avium Kuri. Is that I did a little bit of research, and my impression was that author does not exist in the non-fictional world. And there you at one point kind of move into a space where you spend a little bit of time talking about a story of Avium Kuri's that exists within that world. And then if I remember right, there's kind of a passing line at the end that says that, you know, the book that contains that story stays in a stack of books and remains unread by any of the characters, right? And that sequence, again, I thought was just, it reminded me a little bit of some things that I've seen Roberto Bolaño do, but used in a little bit of a different way than he does. And I thought that technique was used in a very original way. And I just wondered if you wanted to speak a little bit to what effects you used that to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, right, Bolaño would use it to sort of create space. And I particularly magpied this technique from Kurt Vonnegut, where like he has a character called Kilgore Trout that functions similarly as a kind of alter ego. Like when Vonnegut makes up a story that he can't or doesn't want to fully flesh out, he like roughly sketches it and ascribes it to Kilgore Trout in one of his novels.
He actually does that in I think several novels. I think he does,
right.
It.
Yeah.
Anyway,
a recurring character, and sometimes it actually shows in the world of the novel, and it's hilarious. And it's a sort of so I also like think up stories that that for whatever reason I don't have time or capacity or the willingness to write, but then I can also ascribe them to Avim Khoury, where his stories allow me to add a layer of symbolism and radical imagination, or to slow down the plot when it needed respite, like in that moment when Lital and Itamar break down and you. The reader needs a little breather, and so you can bring a story with some radical imagination without imposing it on the plot. So yeah, just a little technique, and I'm glad you noticed it.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the you know, the stories that Zvika would say and these like stories within stories. So yeah, that's super interesting technique. Let's make sure to ask Hans. I feel like we've gotten to all your questions, Hans. Except for one. Where is it? It was about the character who's trans.
Yeah, that's prof. The one. That's the last one in the list. It was interesting to. It was an interesting coincidence that you had that one of the major characters in the novel is trans, because we've dealt recently on the show with a couple of novels that had characters that you could perceive as being transgender, but that were written before the written kind of before the common understanding that we have now of what that even means, right? And so it was a nice contrast, I think, to have that identity written with a little bit more understanding. And I was just wondering how you thought about writing that character, how you prepared to write that character, and what kind of considerations you had in mind in doing so.
Yeah. So this is a big question, like question on representation. And some of what comes up when I hear that is like, what does it mean for me as a gender fluid person assigned male at birth to write a trans woman character? And I think my general approach is in line with that of Olson Whitehead on these issues. Like, if you don't fuck it up, you can do it. So
sure. Sure.
Yeah, that's like in a nutshell. And in my case, some of my prep and care involved having two friends of mine who are trans women read the early drafts, and they gave me great feedback that I used in revision. But still, like, this is something I think every writer, especially in this age, should acknowledge. Like, I'm sure that I made mistakes. And I'm ready to be vulnerable and to recognize that and learn from my mistakes if anything surfaces. But then another really important aspect of this process, and also an important issue that I think isn't discussed enough when we talk about representation, is that when you write something that you don't know, or something that you don't know from personal experience, you also develop empathy for other people. Like, in the same way that reading another person's experience can help you better understand it, writing from another person's perspective can make you more empathetic. And in fact, like, for me, writing Prof's character and other writing projects that I do that also play with gender, it's really helped me and was very influential in regards to my own gender, my understanding of my own gender expression. And some of Prof's experiences, like the freedom she found in anonymous forums and the internet where she could present herself as a girl, those are taken from my own experience as a kid. This is a project also that I wrote over several years, right? So I didn't think of myself as gender nonconforming when I started writing, but gradually I saw more and more of myself in Prof's character. So there are several things. Yeah. So there are several things I was thinking about, like giving representation to people who are part of the movement and whose existence and contributions need to be acknowledged, and then better understanding other experiences and other ways of being human. Like the empathy bit, and finally experimenting with my own gender and identity.
Speaking of empathy, I feel like that's kind of a good point to bridge over to another question. not about gender, but absolutely about empathy and so one major question I had, and for listeners, this is a big spoiler, but you know, and it's a pretty important question, and you know, so if you haven't read the novel yet, press pause, read the novel all the way through, and then press play again. So the climactic moment of the novel, at least from my perspective, appears to be the car ride at the end of the novel, towards the end of the novel, in which Lital and Itamar are in the front seat, and then we've got Aya and Prof in the back, and Aya is threatening Lital's life with a knife. And the reason, you know, I say this is related to empathy is because after this incident, you know, Aya forces Lital to drive Aya and Prof to a place of safety, and they get out and nobody's harmed. But the ramifications on Lital's psyche seem to be to deepen her support of the Israeli occupation and kind of further her hatred of Palestinians. Or at least maybe not. Maybe she doesn't hate Palestinians. Maybe this is the point where she begins to hate Palestinians or something like that. So if we have more empathy in this moment, how does this change the novel? If we have less empathy, if, for example, Aya ends up killing Lital, how does that change the novel?
Wow. yeah. Well, so there are several things. Aya, as a Palestinian person, who, you know, who's basically experienced the war that Israel as a settler state has been waging on her personally and on her people for a century, is justified in retaliating, and it's not like and whether people can have empathy or not, I mean, that's their own question. I personally can empathize with someone who's justified an indigenous person fighting back in whatever way they see fit. But specifically, like, to go into that precise moment, I don't think Aya is the person who would kill someone just because they're racist or because she disagrees with them. She might end up doing that in self-defense. But in the scene, it is a matter of self-defense for Aya. And I think that her demeanor was calculated. Like, she was trying to be terrifying, but she wouldn't have killed Lita. Like, that's how I see it. I don't know.
I think I agree. I think that it, when Aya doesn't end up killing, I think I would have been surprised if she had. You know, I'm not surprised that she doesn't do it.
Yeah. Right. I think Lital in that moment realized that her job as a border police officer wasn't important enough to die for. Like, she chose her family and life instead. Though that might just be my reading of it, and you may have another interpretation. As for what would happen to the novel if Aya did kill Lital, I don't know. Like, I know I'm talking about this novel as a bit of a thought experiment, which is true, but it has certain parameters. Like, the novel is contained within the realm of possibility, given each character's own logic and the rules of this fictional world. So it felt, in a way, once the parameters were established, that the story was already there in the universe, and my job as a writer was to reveal it, like, to carve out the story. So any character's actions, no matter how perplexing or forceful, whether Aya's or Yaniv's or Lital's or Itamar's, like, they became their own actions and not mine, if that makes sense. Like to try
sure,
to...
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So to impose my own experiment on them, quote unquote, like what happens if I kill Lethal would risk making the narrative sort of incoherent. Or
right, right. Absolutely. Okay, okay. I was thinking more... I think I was thinking more thematically, like, but I absolutely see, like, it if Aya kills Lethal, it definitely threatens to make the narrative less realistic. It kind of threatens verisimilitude, so to speak, excuse me. And I guess I was wondering, you know, if an important aspect of this novel is achieving, you know, coming up with, if an important aspect is making the reader have questions about what the proper methods of resistance are, I wonder what it does to those questions if Lethal dies there. I don't know. And, you know, like you said, it's not in line with the characters. So maybe it's not an important question, but
no, I mean, it's a real question and it is a possibility, right? She's holding a knife at her back. Like, maybe it does happen. But there's a whole new set. There's a whole, like, new ending of the novel.
Right. Instead of... So I was thinking, like, no matter what, Ali still gets arrested. But if Aya does kill Lethal, then the police come looking for Itamar as well. So, like you said, it changes the entire logic. So,
yeah, and as for the, like, the ethical question, as I said, like, this may be a question that pushes readers off the fence, like,
right.
Even if nothing changes, like, it stays as it is. Here is a Palestinian woman holding a knife against a police officer's back. And can the reader empathize? And they need to decide how deep is their solidarity.
Yeah, super, super interesting, super, super tricky moment in the novel. You know, that's probably why it sticks with me, probably why I'm really, really wondering about it. Well, was there anything that you'd like to add, Adi, before we sign off?
No, I mean this was a great conversation. Thanks so much for your thoughtful questions and for reading the book and for publishing it and putting it out there for other people to explore. This is, like, incredibly exciting to me, and I'm very grateful.
Excellent, excellent. Oh, well, I mean, it's. For my part, this is kind of why I started the press. I wanted to work with other writers again and you know, try to help put voices out there that, you know, I feel like the small press literary publishing circuit, which is super small compared to big publishing houses. Even at this level, it's still political. It's about, you know, jockeying for academic positions and you know, things like that. And I really didn't want this press to be about that. I just wanted it to be about, you know, people getting their voices out there. So I think it's been awesome working with you. It's been fantastic publishing your novel, and I'm super happy that you decided to submit to us. I'm super happy that you came on the podcast, and it's been awesome.
Yeah, what a great project, and it's so amazing that you're distributing all of these books for free. How do you do it, by the way?
I lose money. I pay a lot of money, basically. That's actually, I actually originally, you know, I started it out by myself. And then come the second year, I was like, I just can't do this alone. There's just, so that's when I asked Hans and Chris to come on board so they could help me. And so, yeah, we just, you know, I spent a lot of money and Chris and Hans spend a lot of their money too. So that's just how we do it. We do get some donations, but not a bunch. I think collectively we probably had maybe $500 of donations in our whole existence. So,
well, I'll be sure to encourage people to donate. Yeah, and anyone listening.
Yes, I actually try to make a point of that on the podcast. Hey, if you want to donate, go to our website, xidracons.org. But again, thank you, Adi. It's been awesome. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode of The God Said of Us. And, you know, I hope that you go to our website. Like I said, that's xidracons.org and request Adi's book because it's free and it's awesome. Peace out, everyone. Until next time.